He was the ultimate social worker for his music. He felt that these needed to go, these songs, or his children, he would say, needed to go to the right family.
Susanna Melvoin was a backup singer and songwriting partner of Prince. Today on The Frame Weekend, we discuss the new album of his previously unheard demos written for other artists. And later, composer Bear McCreary raids his daughter's toy box for inspiration when scoring the new Child's Play movie.
She realized I stole her toy piano and her brightly colored bells, and she said, I want my piano, it's my piano.
Plus, a new opera tells the harrowing story of the Central Park Five. And where does reality end and fiction begin in Martin Scorsese's Rolling Thunder review film about Bob Dylan? I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Stick around. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn, and this is The Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do, and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. A little later today, an Irish actress plays a Scottish singer who wants to make it big in Nashville in the film Wild Rose. But first, when Prince died suddenly in April of 2016, he didn't leave a will, but he did leave behind a treasure trove of unreleased music. Since then, his estate and his family have slowly started sifting through the vaults and releasing some of the best finds so far. This month saw the release of the album Prince Originals. It was first released on the music site Tidal. Now it's available everywhere. The album is comprised entirely of demos Prince recorded that were never intended to reach the public. Songs like this one. Nothing. It's been so lonely with you here. I'm like a bird without a song. That was the 1984 demo by Prince of Nothing Compares to You. That song was originally recorded by the band The Family in 1985. The Family was a group created by Prince as an outlet for some of his music. Among the members was singer Susanna Melvoin. She was also a backup singer, collaborator, and lover of Prince's in the 1980s. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you had had a chance to really sit and listen to this new release, Originals, and if so, what your overall impressions of it are as a full-length record.
I did, and there were a couple interesting feelings I had about it when I first listened to it, which was some of them specifically felt that they were designed specifically for projects. You know, I remember at that time when he was doing some of these tracks, for instance, Manic Monday, being when it finally did go to the Bangles, it was originally for Apollonia 6. So I felt them there were the finished 24-track mm-hmm. versions of these things. You never just threw out demos. They were finished, produced tracks. And then some of them felt very personal. For instance, Nothing Compares to You. When I first heard it this way again with his vocal, that's how I heard it when it came to me in the studio and I was on my way to Los Angeles to do that vocal. The guitar part on that is great. Our version had more space to it. We took mm-hmm. that came out. It becomes an incredible R&B love ballad with Claire Fisher's string arrangements on it. But still, it has a lot of air and it has a lot of breath.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that 1985 version of the Prince song Nothing Compares to You by The Family, featuring my guest, Susanna Melvoin. I could put my arms around every girl I see, but they don't. I went to the doctor, guess what he told me, guess what he told me.
Nothing Compares to You, when it was given to us, it was just heart-wrenching, you know, for many, many reasons, because I was also involved with him at the time.
Right.
So it felt communicative, and it felt personal, and it was. There was a woman that worked with him by the name of Sandy Scipione, who was his personal assistant at the time, who had a death in the family, and she needed to leave. And so he was feeling this longing and loss from Sandy leaving, and also we'd had a rift. And that is a deeply powerful song for me.
And I think it is for everyone.
I think so, too.
And universal.
And for Sinead, who, when she heard this, I know that her manager had called, and I'd spoke with Sinead years later, when and her reason, she had just been loving the family record. She wanted to do a cover of it, and she'd had her manager call Prince and say, we want to do this cover. And here's something that's very unique for him, that he said yes to it. When someone calls and says, I want to do a cover of your song, that would never happen. He was the ultimate social worker for his music. He felt that these needed to go, these songs, or his children, he would say, needed to go to the right family to raise these songs, to raise these kids. I mean, it had a deeper theme than just offering songs out. Like, you can't call me and ask me for this kid. Mm. I have to vet you. And if he didn't vet you or didn't know you or didn't have a relationship with you, he wasn't going to give that up, right?
Yeah.
So, but because Nothing Compares to You had been released on
the way he wanted
the way he wanted it, but it was already out into the public sphere. It's almost like once he's given it away, he's allowed it to sort of sprout itself.
Susanna Melvoin is a singer-songwriter. We've been talking about her collaborations with Prince and much more. Well, you, of course, knew Prince intimately as a person. I think you were engaged for a time, and as an artist as well. And we know that he was fierce in proclaiming his independence from record labels and from the music business in general, that he was known to be exacting in the studio and exact a lot of control over the release of his music. And as high quality and wonderful as these posthumous recordings are, originals and piano and a microphone, do you have any idea how he would feel about their release?
It would never have happened. It would never have happened. The man that I know would have never let anyone have sort of allegiance or license to do anything with his music. So to have released anything just because someone wanted to release these songs, or they need to be heard, it wouldn't have happened, if that makes sense.
Then do you struggle then with sitting here and talking about it?
Do I struggle with it? I suppose so. Although, to be pragmatic and honest, he isn't here, and that's a horrible tragedy. But when someone passes like him, and he has a treasure of music, that I do feel as though on some level it's a responsibility to uphold his legacy, you know, and if I feel it's being done well and in honesty and integrity, that I don't have a problem communicating, you know, my experience, and hopefully through my experience, I'm upholding his legacy and his brilliance. So the family and the estate acting on his behalf is layered, and I think that they're doing this particular project with a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels right to be here and to talk about these things.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
That was Susanna Melvoin, a longtime collaborator of Prince. Her band, The Family, reunited several years ago and continues to perform under the name F Deluxe. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn. And joining me now to talk about some of the top stories in the world of culture this week is Lucas Shaw. He covers the entertainment business for Bloomberg. So, Lucas, you've been reporting on YouTube Kids and its trouble attracting and retaining the audience it's intended to target, namely kids under the age of 14. We're also hearing this week that YouTube itself is under this federal investigation over allegations that it violates children's privacy.
Look, YouTube is embroiled in all sorts of controversies right now because, look, it's got this, it's in the midst of this existential crisis, and the kids' conundrum, to me, is one of the clearest microcosms where what made YouTube great in the first place was that it was this website that anybody could upload a video to at almost little to no cost, right? And that enabled oppressed people who are in, you know, dictatorships to put up videos that they otherwise couldn't have because they couldn't get access to TV networks. It allowed marginalized groups that were not being kind of that were not attractive to Hollywood and traditional entertainment to put videos. It completely democratized celebrity in many respects, and it created this site that everybody uses, not just kids. But that same thing that made it so great, also it gave a powerful platform to all sorts of kind of disgusting people or troubled people that you probably don't want uploading videos. And so what do? YouTube does not want to fundamentally change what it is and cut that off. But it also recognizes that it has to do more to clean it up. And kids is such a tricky spot because we can probably provide some margin for error or accept because of all our belief in free speech that there are people with the rights to put up some nasty stuff that we might not all want to see, but is in legally protected or is speech that, you know, should exist somewhere. But you don't really think about that with kids. You want an experience for kids to be really safe because they can be so easily influenced because they have less control over their impulses. And so how YouTube manages that when it's currently kind of in this faux denial that kids don't use regular YouTube, I'm not sure.
Well, let's move on to the world of music. Spotify is rolling out this new redesign. A lot of users don't seem too happy from what I could gather, too. But what's different, and what does it say about where Spotify is going?
The redesign in question here kind of is mostly on what kind of the library screen. There are three main screens within Spotify, and the third one is kind of your library, where it will display your playlists and the artists and songs you follow and all that. And the big change is that it has historically been really focused just on music, because that's what Spotify's been. It's been a music streaming service. But now, at the very top, you have two big words. You have music and you have podcasts. And so they're given kind of equal weight. And then within either music or podcasts, it's sort of your library of things that you have starred or saved or favorited over the recent history. And it speaks to the evolution of Spotify from a company that, again, was a music streaming service to what is now an audio service. If you're going to listen to anything, and especially on your phone, Spotify wants you to do it in its app as opposed to in Apple Podcasts or on YouTube or anyplace else.
Well, we also this week, Lucas, had news that J.J. Abrams is forging a new partnership between his production company, which is called Bad Robot, and Warner Media. How big of a deal is this going to be?
One of the biggest producer overall deals that we've seen in kind of modern history. Most people value or estimate the value of the deal at $500 million. And the way it'll work is that Warner Brothers, which is a television film studio owned by Warner Media, which is itself owned by the phone company AT&T, will then get kind of first crack or an exclusive right to make any film and television projects that come out of J.J. Abrams' company, Bad Robot. We've seen a slew of these big producer overall deals over the past few years because we're in this moment right now where all these studios are looking to snag the top talent to then feed these new streaming services that they're building. A lot of it precipitated by Netflix, which raised the bar or the price for a lot of these producers, because what Netflix did that other companies weren't doing was it would pay a huge amount of money up front because it would buy out all of the potential profits on a show, what's known in the industry as back end. And so you'd see these headlines about Shonda Rhimes gets a $150 million deal, Ryan Murphy gets a $300 million deal. And for a year or so, it seemed like Netflix was just taking all the big names from Disney, from Fox. And then over the past year, we've seen these traditional studios respond, change the way that they do deals, sort of copy the Netflix model and lean into the relationships they have. None more so really than Warner Brothers, which over the past 12 to 18 months has signed Selma director Ava DuVernay, Greg Berlanti, who produces the most shows on TV of anybody. And just this past week, both J.J. Abrams and John Wells, who is producer of West Wing and Shameless.
Am I often thinking that this almost sounds like a throwback to the old Hollywood studio system, where a studio has this large stable of in-house talents, you know, producers, directors, and stars?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it, because, you know, Netflix did do that vertical integration where it wanted to produce and own everything and just have it sort of filter up, and had used content from a lot of other studios to build its audience, you saw every other studio then get very defensive and want to kind of own those relationships. I got lunch this week with somebody from Disney, and I was floored. They have more than 100 writers and producers in some kind of deal like that. I mean, that's just a tremendous pool of talent to draw from.
Lucas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Martin Scorsese's film about Bob Dylan's 1975 tour. The film's producer, Margaret Bodie, explains the inspiration behind the documentary.
Bob's concept for the Rolling Thunder Review was to really kind of reconnect with both the performers that he wanted to have on the tour with him and with the audiences.
That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. John Horn is away this week. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for joining us. In 1975, Bob Dylan and a band of musicians that included Joan Baez, poet Allen Ginsberg, and the guitarist Mick Ronson set out to tour small towns along the East Coast.
Meet me in the morning, 56 in Wabasha.
In 1978, that footage was used to create an epic film, directed by Dylan, that blurred the lines between fact and fiction. It was called Rinaldo and Clara, and it bombed. But the concept inspired Martin Scorsese when plotting out his new Netflix film. It's called Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story. Producer Margaret Bodie and editor David Tedeschi worked closely with Scorsese on the film.
You know, Bob Dylan came out of Greenwich Village, and I think that the idea was, it's almost like a happening in the 60s. He would bring the village into these little towns in New England.
And so there was this idea of kind of creating more of opportunities for the performers to really make an impact on the audiences and play smaller venues and travel by bus and car and really go back to their roots.
And journalist Larry Sloman talks about that in the film. He was covering the tour at the time for Rolling Stone.
I asked Bob, he was just kind of trying to think of a name for the tour, when all of a sudden in the sky he heard boom, from left to right, boom, 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 boom. So he said, hey, let's call it Rolling Thunder. Chesley Milliken, who was on the tour, says, Bob, you know what Rolling Thunder means to the Indians? And he goes, what, man? And Chesley goes, speaking truth. And then Bob goes, I'm glad to hear that, man.
Now, you've decided not to call this a documentary, and there is a bit of sleight of hand going on in this Netflix film. Why should it not be viewed as a straight documentary of this very real period of Dylan's life and career?
Well, I think Scorsese was very important to him to do something completely different. And in doing something completely different, you know, Netflix has described it as part fever dream. The idea is it's just something else. It's a film, it's music, it's fantasy, it's all of those things together. And of course, Bob Dylan at one point talks about the Commedia dell'arte and how what he wanted to do for this tour was a musical Commedia dell'arte, like these traveling storyteller musicians that will go from town to town, and they would literally do that. They'd arrive in Plymouth the day before the concert, and they would hand out leaflets, and then they'd perform the next night at Memorial Hall. And we noticed right away that a lot of the people on the tour had a kind of an archetypal presence to them. So you have, you know, the Rolling Stone reporter.
Hello.
Bob?
Yeah.
This is Larry.
Yeah, Larry, how you doing?
I gotta do a story in an hour.
Yeah.
And I just need about two or three paragraphs.
Okay.
Are you up?
Yeah, sort of.
And from there, we kind of took off with these archetypes.
The film crew that embedded with the review captured hours of just extraordinary live footage. Why don't we hear something from one of those performances? And I think this is also in the film. And this is Dylan and his band performing a then brand new song called Isis at a show in Boston in the fall of 1975.
She was there in the middle where the creek used to rise, blinded by sleep and in need of a bed.
And it's an extraordinarily vivid performance when you see it, because he has white face and he has a hat with flowers in it. And it has this otherworldly quality on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a very accessible Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and what's interesting is with the Rolling Thunder review tour, those songs were really not known by the audiences. And that's, I think, one of the other things about these performances that are so unique is that, you know, you really are able to see Dylan performing, you know, just vocally, and just his whole being is just committed.
In more recent interviews that you shot with Dylan for this film, kind of reflecting back on the Rolling Thunder tour, he calls it a failure. How, in what way did he see this review as a failure?
The tour lost money. You know, it was really unsustainable. You know, there were too many musicians. It's interesting because, to me, looking at that tour in the context of where music is now and how it's evolved, you can't even imagine any kind of tour that doesn't have either a sponsored or a corporate or some kind of, it's almost all about that. And I think this part of history could kind of maybe remind us that there's other reasons to go perform music in front of audiences.
It wasn't a success. Not if you measure success in terms of profit. But it was a sense of adventure. So, in many ways, yes, it was very successful.
You've both been longtime collaborators of director Martin Scorsese. And, of course, he's well known for his fictional films, but also his documentaries like The Last Waltz, Shine a Light. Do you think there's an overarching theme behind what Scorsese chooses to do with his documentaries? Is there some sort of connective tissue?
I see what he does. It's kind of a cultural preservation. He's so eager for particularly young people to be introduced to these musicians and performers and artists from the past, and that are, you know, still very vital and with us today. Obviously, Scorsese has made these iconic and landmark works of fiction. If he had only made documentaries, I think he would be an incredible documentarian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a kind of incredible to think that he is so powerful in both genres and both formats.
I would just add, I haven't counted. I don't know how many films we've done together, but it's, you know, in the range of 6 or 7. Mm. And every single project, what it comes down to is he ends up saying relatively early in the project, let's have fun with this. This is something we could have fun with. And that's the truth of the documentaries he's working on. It's not like they're necessarily going to make so much money, you know, but they're giving him an outlet to say something that I think he wouldn't be able to say otherwise.
Margaret, David, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. Video games are often criticized for encouraging violence, but some creators want to make games that do the opposite. Connie Geppert is a video game designer and the co-founder of the Berlin-based production house Yomai Games. She grew up in East Germany in a small fishing village. Her new game, Sea of Solitude, aims to tackle depression and anxiety.
The setting on Sea of Solitude, the game I develop, is Berlin, my chosen hometown, where I live now for 20 years. It's loosely based on Berlin, but there are actually real settings in there, like train stations that you can recognize if you're in Berlin and if you played the game. But I love my hometown, my real hometown in the Baltic Sea. I grew up next to the beach. My family are fishermen, so I had been in boats often. And so it was always like water and big cities, what I love. Sea of Solitude is about this young woman named Kay, who's suffering from such strong loneliness that her inner feeling, the darkness, the anger, the feeling of hopelessness, worthlessness, turns to the outside and she becomes a monster. The game is about finding out why this happened to her, but also how to turn her back into a human.
And what are some of the challenges involved in that journey?
So, like story-wise, the biggest challenge for her is to figure out what issues she actually has. She, at the beginning, has some kind of amnesia. She doesn't even know that she has issues.
Wait. That monster, it seems familiar.
But she sees that something seems to be wrong with her. So step by step, by interacting with other beings in this world that are connected to her closely, she figures out that she actually has issues. And step by step, she figures out, okay, this is why I am right now like I am.
Oh, you're trapped again. Let me help.
We're talking with Connie Geppert. She's the creator of the video game Sea of Solitude. We talked about how the sea and where you grew up was very much influential in the environment for Sea of Solitude.
Yeah.
But why ultimately did you choose to set it in this flooded world?
Yeah.
I would imagine, I guess, knowing the sea so well that you know its power, its danger, as well as its,
yes,
as its beauty.
Yes, I almost drowned, like, I think, 3 times in my life. So I know the danger,
wow.
But also I love swimming and diving and everything. Sea of Solitude is deeply metaphorical. So the water itself has a deep meaning, the rising, the lowering. And I let it open for the player to interpret why is the water rising at some point and the main character cannot access areas anymore, or why is it lowering in between to the very ocean ground and then she can go there? Why?
And so, I mean, a player could see it on different levels. They could just see it as a fun game, or they can see it on this much deeper level, I suppose.
Yes, yes. So this is my was my main goal, that in this game you meet other monsters in between that are much bigger in size,
mm-hmm.
and they are in the core also humans that suffer from different types of loneliness. You don't always need to have like mental health issues or something. We all, like humans, you and me, suffer or know the feeling of loneliness. So this I portray too in the game.
Oh, it looks so sad.
Last year, when I addressed it at E3 on stage, and millions of people saw it, gulp. afterwards, literally hundreds of fans wrote me, and like almost every one of them told me that just alone because I mentioned the scene that I opened up about loneliness, that I felt this way, they felt less lonely and hurt and could relate. And I cried in between when I looked at all the fan mails that they already felt better just because someone, yeah, opened up about an issue they have. But with the game, I also try to show how I overcame my issues. And it's not about becoming a total superhero at the end, that everything is fine. You know, we always will have ups and downs. It will not, that is reality. But to get a little bit more okay with also the downsides of life, to
right.
be more calm and okay with how you are, with the bad things, the good things, this is what I try to show.
Connie, thank you again so much.
And yeah, thank you for having me.
The video game Sea of Solitude is available July 5th. This is The Frame Weekend, and I'm Stephen Cuevas. A warning here, the next segment contains references to sexual assault. So it's been 30 years since the violent rape of a jogger in New York's Central Park riveted a city and painted this portrait of the accused.
Roaming gangs of teenagers attack a 28-year-old woman, hitting her with fists and rocks. 4 of them rape her and leave her there unconscious.
The wrongful conviction of 5 young Black and Latino teenagers and how they were vilified by the police and the press remains ever relevant. And now there's an opera called The Central Park 5, making its premiere at the Long Beach Opera. The composer is Anthony Davis.
Hip-hop really went mainstream in 1989.
Right.
And so I began to think about how I could incorporate that musical language into mine. know, I decided not to do, you know, hip hop lyrics, et cetera, but, right. but to use the speech rhythm and aspect of it, particularly in We Are the Freaks.
We are the freaks. We are the freaks who run the night. We are the freaks.
Which is a George Clinton reference, yeah?
Yes, it's definitely referring to George Clinton, yeah.
We are the freaks. We are the Blade Runners who can't compete.
And that's the way hip hop traditionally borrows also from earlier forms of African American popular music. So I was sort of curious to do that. So in a way of doing a parody of something that the hip hop itself would draw from.
It seemed to my ears that the first half of the opera, the music seemed much more discordant than the second half.
I think part of it is that in the first half of the opera, you see a lot of the interrogation. Mm. And the interrogation is, I looked at it as a manipulation. So in effect, using the rhythmic aspect of the music, it propels the district attorney and the mask figure in their interrogation of the Central Park Five. So a lot of it is creating that stress through the rhythmic tension. And then there are lyrical moments, certainly, you know, when no one's smiling anymore, you know, when they sing together. There's sort of there's sections where they're almost drawing from Take Six and some of the vocal groups of the 80s and
right,
stuff, you know, using
right.
close harmony and
yes.
and using that kind of harmony for the voices. And so some lyricism comes out of that, and also to in a sense of the, so we feel empathy for them. How what they're feeling when during this whole process of the trial
mm-hmm.
and the way they play on their fears.
You worked with the librettist Richard Wesley on this work. Can you talk about what was involved in developing the voices of the main characters, of the boys, these boys aged like 14 to 16? So it really reflected who they were at the time.
That was an interesting problem because, in a way, when we first approached it, we were thinking of having, you know, double cast, have the young
right.
Central Park Five and try to cast closer to their age and then the older Central Park Five. But that became too complicated. That was way too complicated. And then we thought about, you know, eventually to have them as the older Central Park Five, about what their ages would be now, reflecting back and then sort of inhabiting their younger selves.
Yeah.
What they were when this all happened.
In one scene in the opera, we hear the character of Trisha Miley, who was the jogger who was assaulted and raped and nearly lost her life. We don't see her, but I believe it's in the trial sequence, and she's giving
right.
testimony. We only hear her voice from offstage singing. Why did you choose to have her be heard but not seen?
Because we were more interested in the effect of the fact that she didn't remember. She couldn't remember what happened, that the disappointment of the five that she didn't remember, because they were hoping that they would be exonerated because of her testimony.
Well, the opera's been in production for a while, but the premiere now comes on the heels of Ava DuVernay's four-part series from Netflix documenting what happened. Her series and your opera could have come at almost any time, really, in the last 10 or 12 years. Why do you think now is the time to revisit this story, and why do you think it's resonating with so many people?
Well, I think one of the factors is the election of Donald Trump.
Mm.
I mean, we now have a person in power whose political career began with the Central Park Five. That's where his whole playbook of using race and using racial division, using the rhetoric that he uses began, and we saw that in the presidential campaign, and he's still refuses to apologize or acknowledge that the Central Park Five were innocent.
He doubled down on it.
He does. As does Linda Fairstein,
the prosecutor.
There was no physical evidence tying them to the rape and assault. So it's kind of outrageous that she still holds that view.
Anthony Davis is the composer of the new opera, The Central Park Five, produced by the Long Beach Opera and on stage now at the Warner Grand Theater in San Pedro. Anthony, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Final performances of The Central Park Five are this weekend, June 22nd and 23rd. Coming up, an Irish actress who got her big break on a BBC singing competition show is now the lead in a movie. It's The Frame Weekend. We'll be right back. It's The Frame Weekend, and I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn. A beloved toy has returned to movie theaters this weekend. Nope, I'm not talking about Woody the Cowboy. I'm talking about Chucky, the killer doll. A new reboot of the 1988 horror film Child's Play is campy and creepy in all kinds of ways, down to its dementedly childlike score. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving gets the story from the film's composer.
The original Child's Play was like the forbidden fruit. It was a tattered VHS box on the shelf at the rental store that was like haunting my nightmares. There's something so inherently seductive about it when you're a little kid.
Andy, no, please. We're friends to the end, remember?
This is the end, friend.
It was not something I ever thought I would get to play around with.
Bear McCreary is a film and TV composer best known for The Walking Dead and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He scored two of this summer's big movies, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and the new Child's Play, directed by Lars Klevberg.
I mean, he has described this movie as E.T. on acid. And I basically pitched him this idea. What if we scored the movie with toys? I wasn't making the toys creepy. I just found the ones that are. Well, show me some
of these. We're in McCreary's studio in Culver City. All around the room are stacks of hurdy-gurdies, accordions, and other quirky, toyish instruments, including a variety of toy pianos.
This one's my favorite.
We sit down on a couch in front of a coffee table where a handful of toy pianos, of varying size, sit side by side.
The tuning, it is not only in a completely different key, and you can see on the keys it says what notes they are, and it's a lie. Those are not the notes. That is not a C. But the tuning is especially weird. Take a listen to this. If I play it in a different key, you'll hear it even more. These are supposed to be different notes. Once my 5-year-old daughter got wind of what I was doing, she came in and started looking around and tapped the toy pianos. And she realized I stole her toy piano and her brightly colored bells. And she said, I want my piano. It's my piano. Multiple times I had to pick up this toy piano, and it's not one of the smaller ones, take it back into the house, set it in her playroom. She would play it for like a minute and then go do something else. And then when she's not looking, I'd pick it back up and bring it back out here. And yeah, that was really fun. I definitely borrowed a lot of toys from her room. So you have these sounds. That's Chucky's new theme. So these little things, they look like Muppets, but they're called automatones.
It's true. They have Muppety-looking heads, but with a silicone texture and a body shaped like a musical note. Almost like an upside-down Pez dispenser with a giant manipulable mouth.
And they essentially are like a ribbon controller synthesizer that has a little face, and when you make it talk, it verbalizes a sort of a wah-wah sound. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's the funniest thing in the world.
He pulls out a different kind of automatone. This one's just a giant Muppet-like head.
The larger automatone has a more digital sound. I am not very good at it. But what I was able to do within these sort of choir textures, I was able to create what sounds to me like a little doll. And I would stack these and I would play them slightly out of tune with each other. And it just sounds like in the middle of this horrific score, like there's a little doll going, Mama, Mama. I'm just going to play you the theme. And the first thing you're going to hear the toy pianos and the auto harps. And then immediately you will hear the vocals. And my voice is featured very prominently in the film. You might think it's a choir of 12-year-old girls, but it's me.
Hey,
In the movie, the consumer version of the Chucky doll, aka the non-demonic version, is programmed to sing a friendly little tune called the Buddy Song. Bear McCreary knew he would get to write that song, but...
What I did not know when I signed on to the movie was that they were going to cast Mark Hamill as Chucky. And sort of an unexpected surprise was that Mark really can sing.
You are my buddy until the end. More than a buddy, you're my best friend.
And Chucky sings it throughout the movie, and it kind of becomes twisted and sinister as his relationship with Andy changes.
You are my buddy until the end. More than a buddy, you're my best friend.
This creepy little ditty by Bear McCreary is coming to a theater near you. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
I will never let you go. I am your buddy.
Child's Play is in theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. And now for a very different movie with very different music.
Had to find my way, make my own mistakes, but you know that I had to go.
Wild Rose is about Rose Lynn, a woman fresh out of prison with broken relationships to mend and two kids to feed, who also has a hunger to become a Nashville country music superstar.
I'm actually trying to get to Nashville, you know.
Oh.
I'm needing to raise a couple of grand so I can get flights and hotel and... And it wouldn't it be more than two or three, definitely less than five.
Oh, Rosalind, I'm sorry, I can't just give you money. That's what you're suggesting, which I'm sure it wasn't.
No, it was.
The problem isn't just money. She lives 4,000 miles away from Nashville in Glasgow, Scotland. Rose Lynn is played by Irish actress Jessie Buckley. She got her first big break 11 years ago when she appeared on the BBC singing competition show called I'd Do Anything.
Well, I was coming over to... I'd finished school and I was taking a gap year. And in between, I was applying for drama school to study musical theatre.
A gap year in the US?
I live in the UK. Yeah, I live in London, yeah.
Got it.
And I went to audition for this drama school and I didn't get in. And on the same weekend, there was like an open audition for this TV talent show and I had another drama school audition coming up. So I was like, well, I'll just go and practice my songs. Anyway, basically, I kept going and came second. I mean, I don't know how I slipped through the net because I was crap a lot of the weeks. And I was so like innocent and ignorant to the whole business of it, you know.
So what attracted you to Nicole Taylor's script for Wild Rose?
Well, I read it first because Tom Harper, who I'd worked with on War and Peace, had got sent the script and we were having a pint and he was like, oh, I'd really love you to read it. I would only want to do it if you did it. So I love Tom and he could have told me to lie down on a train track and I'd be like, yeah, sure, what time's the train and when are we going? But I then met Nicole and when I read the script, it was just... I'd never really read a woman as irreverently fearless and she's like a tornado in lots of ways.
Yeah.
She has come out of prison ready to just take on the world and she's put the blinkers on of everything that might stop her. And so she's trying to run as far away from who she is and where she's from and what her responsibilities are because she believes that's the only way that she can... catch her dream.
Well, a big eight wheel rolling down the track means a true love of mine ain't coming back. I'm moving on. I'll soon be gone. You were flying too high for my little sky. I'm moving on.
And you play a Scottish woman who's like enthralled with American country music, but you're Irish. Were you aware of any of this music?
No, I had no relationship to country music at all before I started this. And I thought it was, I don't know, my peripheral was that it was a bit like, wah-ba-dam, you know, kind of hick. But when I found it and found the really good stuff and the lyrics, really, and the stories that exist within these songs, which are kind of 3-minute movies, it's completely stolen my heart. And it is quite like Irish music in ways, you know. There's that kind of tradition in Ireland of the storyteller. They call
That's
it
right.
They call it the Shanachí, which is this guy who's a travelling storyteller who just travels from town to town with a box and goes into different pubs and stands on this box and recites stories about these different characters that he's met on his travels. And even within the music, there's a lot of resemblances with folk Irish music and folk country music and even the tonality. And it's quite simple, but it's very emotionally deep.
I'm talking to Jesse Buckley, who stars in the new film Wild Rose. Did you have any say, did you have any input over what songs were used for the film from other artists?
When I was first kind of coming to terms with country music and learning it and figuring out what Rosalind's voice was within this genre, I would... And other musicians like Neil McCall and Jack Arnold, who was our music supervisor, we all bottled up to this shed up in North London every 2 weeks. And there are some songs which, I don't know, you're looking, I suppose, within the film, the songs are an extension of the scene. Or sometimes not, but tonally you're looking for something which will tell a story or an emotional beat of what Rosalind wants to say that she can't say in her real life.
Right.
And often it's just energy-wise. You know, some songs we took, like Country Girl, the Primal Scream song, which is at the very beginning of the film, that was something which came kind of later, but it was so right and so, you know, their version is quite punk rock, whereas ours, we kind of arranged it more country in it, but it just had that irreverence and ballsiness, and you couldn't get like more, like a better kind of feel for the beginning of that film, because you immediately have a sense of who this woman is and where that frustration and that drive is coming from within that song.
Country girl, take my hand, lead me through this disease land. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn.
But it's a thing that's kept growing organically. We did all the music live, and so some the songs would just take on their own shape within the scenes.
Well, Rosalind's quest is to get to Nashville to break into country music, and she, I think, has a very romanticized vision of what the city of Nashville is and what it represents. I know you were not that well acquainted with country music when you got there.
Well, like, we nearly didn't make it to Nashville at first, because when we were initially meant to go, our visas got lost. So, you know, and you can't book the Ryman willy-nilly just because your visa gets lost. So we actually didn't think that we were going to make it.
Oh, wow.
And our whole shoot went on hold for like 4 or 5 weeks. So we didn't know if we were going to even get to that part. So when we got there, it was kind of like resembling Rosalind's whole journey in itself. So we got there and it was like this kind of hallowed ground of like, oh my God, we're here.
I was born without a whisper. I was born beneath the rain. And when I reach...
So the character of Rosalind, her employer, who's wealthy, kind of recognizes her talent and helps her get on to this larger stage in front of this audience of people that could support her in her career. And she has a difficult time when she's finally up on that stage. Like, she freezes up. The way you played that scene, did it come from any personal experience at all? Could you draw on anything that's ever happened to you as a performer?
Oh, I've had moments like that. It's never stopped me. Even while I was filming Wild Rose and I was in a really, like, trusting environment, I was getting the most horrendous panic attacks like before scenes. And it's always interesting what scenes would initiate those attacks. But it's never, I mean, the thing is you can't. Especially if you're on set on a small, you know, you're part of a team and you've got to pull yourself together. And Tom was incredible, because actually whenever those times would happen, he would take me aside and say, no, well, he'd be like, are you okay? But he's also like, this is very honest and this is human, and maybe put it into the scene, see what happens.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
That was Jessie Buckley. She's starring in the movie Wild Rose. It's in theaters now.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of no rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living. Just a hard way to go.
And that's all for The Frame Weekend. This program is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. Our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm Stephen Cuevas in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. You can join John Horn on Monday for the weekday edition of The Frame.